Hello, I'm Suzanne Green, an Associate Director of Neutral Management at FINRA Dispute Resolution. I want to welcome and thank you for listening to this Neutral Workshop. Today we will discuss Arbitrator Feedback Review, the top 10. We will use the peer, party, and staff evaluations returned after the conclusion of a case to highlight areas where arbitrators are performing well and where improvements are perceived to be necessary. I'm pleased to introduce you to our FINRA faculty. George Friedman, Executive Vice President of FINRA Dispute Resolution, Rick Berry, Senior Vice President and Director of Case Administration and Regional Office Services, and Catherine Bayer, Regional Director of the Northeast Region. During this workshop, Catherine will begin by sharing the top five areas where peers, parties, and staff have evaluated arbitrators extremely well. Then Rick will explore the top five areas where improvements are perceived to be necessary based on evaluation form feedback. And finally, George will summarize the major events of the past year. As a preliminary matter, you can view all of the materials referenced in this workshop by clicking on the links right below the audio file that you just downloaded from our website. We'll let you know when a topic includes reference materials you might want to review. Competent and effective arbitrators are a fundamental component of the arbitration system. Arbitrator evaluations are an essential part of FINRA Dispute Resolution's continuing effort to ensure that arbitrators are well qualified. Arbitrator evaluations are a valuable way to assess an arbitrator's knowledge of the process, attentiveness, and objectivity. We use the feedback from the evaluations to coach and counsel the arbitrators as necessary, without ever revealing the identity of the arbitrator, party, or staff member who provided the evaluation. For this workshop, we reviewed peer, party, and staff arbitrator evaluations to come up with a top 10 list. The hearing script reminds parties to complete an evaluation at the conclusion of any case, including those that settle. By the way, we ask the parties to submit their surveys before the award is issued, so their views are not influenced by the outcome. Arbitrators should take this opportunity to remember their obligation to evaluate their peers as well. The peer and party arbitrator evaluation forms are available online at www.finra.org on the Forms and Tools page. Links to the forms are also located right below the audio link for this workshop. Because FINRA Dispute Resolution staff members interact with arbitrators throughout the hearing process, the staff is also encouraged to objectively review each arbitrator's performance on a case-by-case basis. We encourage all arbitrators to complete the appropriate evaluation forms after the award has been finalized, or after the case has settled or withdrawn. Catherine, will you please share with our neutrals the top five areas where the arbitrators are most highly rated?
Yes, I will. Thanks, Suzanne. These are the top five areas where peers, parties, and staff have evaluated arbitrators highly. Number one, understand and properly apply FINRA arbitration rules and procedures. I commend you all on this high rating. This is a reflection of your continued duty to stay abreast of rule changes and current events. One party recently wrote on an evaluation that the chairperson of the panel had an excellent grasp of the rules. That's the kind of thing we like to see. Another party wrote that one of the panelists was able to clearly cite FINRA rules and procedures. There are several ways to continue to stay current on rule and procedural changes. First of all, continue to listen to our neutral workshops. Read our arbitrator newsletter, The Neutral Corner, each time a new issue is published online. Visit our website frequently for a wealth of information. Request a subscription to the DR Monthly newsletter by registering on our website or by clicking on the subscription link below this audio file.
So, Catherine, this is George. DR meaning?
Dispute resolution.
Okay, just checking.
Thank you, George. Finally, continue to take advantage of advanced training modules. Two training modules were released this year, one on explained decisions and one on motions to dismiss. For a limited time, the tuition for all of our training modules is being waived. Number two, decide discovery and motions in a timely manner. In some cases, the full panel will resolve discovery issues. In most instances, however, FINRA will appoint the chairperson of the panel to manage the discovery process. A detailed initial pre-hearing conference scheduling order will make managing discovery an easier task. That said, many thanks to our chairpersons who are reviewing discovery-related material promptly. We encourage you to continue this valuable practice. Adhering to a strict discovery schedule and deciding discovery motions in a timely manner is a key factor to maintain scheduled hearing dates. With regard to motions that require review by the full panel, thanks to all of our arbitrators who do this in a timely fashion. If you are serving on an active case and you will be unreachable for more than a few days, we encourage you to email or call your assigned staff member to let them know. Number three, remain unbiased and treat both parties fairly. Each time you agree to serve in a case, you read and execute an oath of arbitrator that states you will decide the controversy in a fair manner. Based on the evaluations we reviewed in preparation for this workshop, you are clearly meeting this goal. Parties, peers, and staff overwhelmingly state that they believe arbitrators are unbiased and treat both parties fairly. A co-panelist recently said the chair of his panel maintained an unbiased, objective manner throughout the proceedings. She was courteous and respectful of all parties, their representatives, and her co-panelists. Although arbitrators received high marks in this area, here are a few reminders for continued success. Be sure to preside with an even hand. Be fair and impartial both in appearance and in fact when addressing parties and their counsel. Always balance the equities of a potential prejudice against a speedy resolution to the matter. Number four, display an ability to analyze problems and identify key issues. A recent party evaluation stated the arbitrator had an outstanding ability to focus directly on the issues and evidence. Another party wrote, "The arbitrator is a seasoned arbitrator who is extremely good at getting directly to the issue. His experience was priceless during the arbitration process." Preparation is one of the keys to this area of success. Reread all of the pleadings before the hearing to assist you in identifying the main issues of the case. Finally, number five, listen attentively and display a professional demeanor. Being a good listener is a common skill among respected arbitrators. While the facts of a case may not always be straightforward, applying your listening skills will assist you in rendering an impartial decision. An arbitrator's demeanor is very important because an innocuous question, glance, or facial expression may be misinterpreted by the parties. Similarly, while an arbitrator may close his eyes while in pensive thought, the parties may erroneously perceive this as the arbitrator napping. That wraps up the top five areas where arbitrators are performing well based on party, peer, and staff feedback. Now Rick is going to highlight areas where improvements are perceived to be necessary based on evaluations submitted.
Thanks, Catherine. The first of the five areas where there is perceived room for improvement is keeping your disclosure report up to date and accurate. It cannot be emphasized enough that arbitrators must disclose each and every fact from the point of view of any participant that might affect the arbitrator's objectivity or even appear to do so. Rule 12408 of the Code of Arbitration Procedure requires each arbitrator to disclose any circumstances that might preclude an impartial determination or create an appearance of partiality or bias. Disclosure is so important that, in addition to disclosing known relationships, you must also make a reasonable effort to inform yourself of potential conflicts involving your employers, partners, business associates, and family members. It is essential that the arbitrator information provided to parties by FINRA is accurate and up to date. For this reason, arbitrators have a continuing obligation to update the roster information that we maintain on their behalf. There are currently three ways that you can update your arbitrator profile. First, use the arbitrator information update form on our website. www.finra.org. This form is a quick and easy way to add or update information in your arbitrator profile. A link to the arbitrator information update form is below the link to this audio file for this workshop. Second, you may scan your arbitrator disclosure report with handwritten updates and email it to panelupdate@finra.org. Third, you can fax updates to neutral management staff at 301-527-4910. It is especially important to update your information when you are appointed to a case. We will send you your information as it exists in our records and ask that you review it for accuracy at the same time as you complete and return the arbitrator disclosure checklist. An often overlooked area on arbitrator disclosure reports is the background narrative. Please remember to update your narrative accordingly when there are substantive changes to your employment. If you still have questions about disclosure, there's an advanced training module titled Your Duty to Disclose. And as a reminder, FINRA is currently waiving the fee for all training courses and offering to you at no charge. Number two, do not cause a delay in the hearings. For starters, be sure that your schedule allows you to serve on a case. It's in the best interest of all involved to decline an appointment if you are not available to conduct the hearing promptly. A major goal of arbitration is the prompt resolution of disputes. At the time of appointment, arbitrators should be certain that they have the time to hear and decide the controversy in a timely manner. If you're serving on another FINRA case and are unsure if the case is going forward, check with staff. Please do not double book hearings with the hope one case will settle. Have your business and personal calendars available at the initial pre-hearing conference and know your availability for 6 to 12 months after the IPHC, the initial pre-hearing conference. As soon as the hearing dates are set, note the dates in your business and personal calendars. Also, put in the time to which you committed. The parties have expended a great deal of time and money in preparing for the hearing and deserve to have their case heard by dedicated, earnest arbitrators who respect everyone's schedules. The party should be able to rely on the arbitrators to appear on time and stay for the duration of the day, as initially agreed upon. FINRA does not consider non-emergency conflicts to be valid reasons for canceling a previously scheduled hearing or ending a hearing day early. If a last-minute court appearance or similar event interferes with scheduled arbitration dates, see if someone else can cover for you at the other event. Try to get that event adjourned and not the arbitration hearing. If you do face an unavoidable conflict, please inform FINRA immediately so that parties can be notified. Number three, gain a better understanding of the expungement process. The third item on the Room for Improvement top five list is gaining a better understanding of the expungement process. FINRA operates the CRD system, which is an online registration and licensing system. The CRD system contains information regarding members and registered persons, including disclosure information relating to customer disputes. When a registered person is named as a respondent in a customer-initiated arbitration proceeding, the registered person's employer, or former employer, is required to report the incident, resulting in the incident then appearing on the registered person's CRD record.
That would happen even if they're not named, but their conduct is described, and it's pretty clear who the customer is talking about, right?
That's exactly right. A rule change that went into effect in 2009 means that even unnamed brokers who are not in the caption, but may be mentioned in the statement of claim in a different capacity, or can be reasonably identified, can be and will have their U4 form updated. If the arbitration claim against the registered person is denied by the arbitrators, the registered person may seek to have any reference to the arbitration removed from his or her CRD record. Because expungement relief is extraordinary, under FINRA Rule 2080, formerly 2130, which went into effect in April 2004, arbitrators can order expungement of customer dispute information only when they have affirmatively found that the claim, allegation, or information in the customer dispute is factually impossible or clearly erroneous, or the registered person was not involved in the alleged misconduct, or the claim, allegation, or information is false. And arbitrators must follow the procedural requirements under Rules 12805 and 13805. By way of review, as of January 2009, in addition to the current requirement that the arbitrators state expressly which of the narrow grounds for expungement serve as the basis for their order, the 2009 rule change established a procedure arbitrators must follow in considering expungement requests for customer complaints. Specifically, the code now requires that arbitrators hold a recorded hearing by telephone or in person to ensure that arbitrators consider the facts for and against expungement. Note, this is particularly important in cases in which the parties have settled and seek a stipulated award, and the terms of the settlement agreement require the customer to consent to request for expungement. The code also requires, in the case of a settlement, the arbitrators to review the settlement documents to examine the amounts paid to any party and any other terms and conditions of the settlement before awarding expungement. It requires arbitrators to provide a brief written explanation for their ruling and to assess forum fees for hearing sessions held solely for the purpose of considering expungement against the parties requesting relief. There are several excellent resources available to assist you in better understanding the expungement process: the Advanced Arbitrator Training Module on Expungement, the Neutral Workshop recorded on December 10, 2008, the Neutral Corner, Volume 1, 2009, article on expungement, Establishing Procedures for Arbitrators Considering Expungement Requests, FAQ, and FINRA Rule 2080 and Code of Arbitration Procedure Rules 12805 and 13805. Links to all of the reference materials are below the audio link for this workshop. The fourth area of recommended improvement has been reported by FINRA staff. Staff would like to remind our arbitrators to accurately complete their travel and expense reports. Here are a few general tips for completing the expense form. All travel and expenses related to serving on a case must be submitted within 30 days of the date the expense was incurred. Download the travel and expense form in Excel from our website. A link to the form is below is the audio link to this workshop. And the form will automatically calculate mileage at the correct rate. Please note that the travel and expense form is updated periodically, so we encourage you to download the form each time you need it. Attach receipts for all expenses of $10 or more. Be sure to include the case number and name of the form and sign the form before submitting. Please do not leave any information on the form blank. Missing information will only delay the processing of the form. A new training video will be released in early 2011 to highlight how to properly complete the travel and expense form. We will send you an email alert when the new training video is available. In the meantime, please review the guidelines for arbitrator reimbursement if you have any questions, or reach out to a staff member who is assigned to your case. Finally, number five, have a better understanding of fees. The final area where parties, peers, and staff have called out for improvement is the fee area. Specifically, an awareness of all the different fee types, amounts, and how to properly calculate the number of hearing sessions to determine forum fees. With regard to forum fees, parties are assessed forum fees or hearing session fees based on the number of hearing sessions held. A single session is any meeting between the parties and arbitrators that lasts 4 hours or less. The award information sheet lists all the possible fees on a case. If a case settles or is withdrawn before an award, you still need to consider all fees. Some common fee types are filing fees, member fees, hearing session or forum fees, subpoena fees, postponement fees, last minute adjournment fees, and explained decision fees.
Great, thanks so much, Rick. There are several additional resources that I'd like to review as we conclude the Arbitrator Feedback Review, the Top 10. First, review the Top 10 Ways to Be a Better Arbitrator. A link is available under the audio file for this workshop. Next, FINRA designed the pre-hearing and hearing scripts to facilitate the process. Arbitrators should use the scripts to the greatest extent possible. And an important note on the scripts, there are numerous changes to the initial pre-hearing conference and hearing scripts each year. So if you have a hard copy of the script, please check our website to ensure that you're using the most up-to-date version of the script. One of our primary goals is delivering high-quality customer service to our parties and neutrals. So please reach out to an information specialist or the staff member assigned to your case with any questions that you have. We have dedicated staff members waiting to take your calls. Now I'm happy to pass the mic to George Friedman. George, will you please provide an overview of the highlights of the past year?
Sure, Suzanne, and happy holidays to everybody. Lots to talk about here. Let me start. Of most excitement and importance, an update on the public arbitrator pilot program. On October 25th, FINRA filed a rule proposal with the SEC that would expand the to all investor claims a two-year-old FINRA pilot program that gives investors filing an arbitration claim against certain firms the option of choosing an all-public panel. Now, you probably heard some limitation words there. Certain firms, limited number of cases, cases only involving firms. Now, the pilot greatly increases investor choice in the FINRA arbitration program. A rule making this permanent to all firms and all claims would do even more. So we file the rule, and if it's approved by the commission, it would give the investor the option of choosing an arbitration panel in three arbitrator cases that has two public arbitrators and one non-public arbitrators. That's now the norm. That's not big news. Or, and here's the drum roll, choosing to have their case heard by an all-public panel. So again, this would be an investor choice on the way in, and I'll describe it in a minute, to have an all-public panel if that's what the investor wants. I remind you, investors already get a single chair-qualified public arbitrator for cases involving less than $100,000. So, as I said, a few minutes ago, the rule is based on the pilot program. A little bit about that. The current pilot program involves 14 firms that voluntarily agreed to set up a number to allow a number of investor cases that did not involve individual brokers to be in the pilot. And in the pilot, the customer gets a choice, essentially, of an all-public panel. Now, as I mentioned, the proposed rule is broader than the pilot program because it applies to all investor disputes with any firm and also would include cases involving individual brokers. Let me just repeat that. It's an important difference. All investor claims, any firm, including claims involving individual brokers. Now, the comment period already closed on December 3rd, and we're in the midst of analyzing the comments. There have been more than 125, which, by the way, were overwhelmingly positive. So we're analyzing those now, and we'll be responding shortly. But here's the bottom line, folks. If the rule's approved, no investor in our forum will have a non-public arbitrator on their case if they don't want one. That's simply how it comes down. No investor would have a non-public arbitrator on their case if they don't want one. Now, the proposed rule would not apply to arbitration disputes involving only industry parties. That's important to note. Now, a little bit of review. I think we didn't have formal introductions, but I teach at Fordham Law School. So the professorial side requires that I do a little bit of review about how the pilot works, because, indeed, this is how the rule is going to work. Now, under the pilot and under the rule, if approved, parties get the same list of arbitrators they get in any three arbitrator case. Again, by way of review, parties now get 10 chair-qualified public arbitrators on their list, 10 public arbitrators, and 10 non-public arbitrators. Again, under current rules, parties are allowed to strike up to 4 names from any list. Here's where we read the part. The pilot and the rule would work a little differently in that on the non-public list, any party could strike up to all 10 names. So again, whereas there's the right to strike only up to 4 per party on each of the lists, on the non-public list, any party could strike up to all 10 names. So then what happens? Well, if all of the if there are industry or non-public arbitrators left on the list, then we'll appoint them. If that fails, if there are none left, either because they've been stricken or the non-public arbitrators can't serve, we'll then go back and say, do we have any public arbitrators left on the other list? If there are, we'll appoint one of them. If not, we go to the computer system, the Matrix computer system, and say, give us, on a random basis, a public arbitrator. The net result, of course, is an all-public panel. That's how the pilot works, and that's how the rule would work if approved. Now, again, it's investor choice coming in. So the first thing that happens is the investor is given the choice of opting into the pilot. And if the rules approve, the investor would have the choice of opting in to getting this special list selection procedure. So what's happened so far? We committed to measure several things. The percentage of investors who opt in, probably the first measure. The answer on that is roughly 60% of the time, given a choice, the investor has opted in. The second measure is, okay, well, once they opt in, how often is the investor leaving one or more non-public arbitrators on the list? Because, again, they can strike up to all eight names. And the answer is, about half the time, the investor is ranking one or more non-public arbitrators. Now, my math skills, my colleagues are chuckling, are not that strong, but you kind of put that together, and that would seem to indicate that about three-quarters of the time, they're chuckling, three-quarters of the time, the investor has indicated a willingness to have a non-public arbitrator on the case, either by not opting in and getting a regular list, or by opting in and leaving and ranking non-public arbitrators. So those are important stats. We've also committed to measure other things like how quickly do these cases go, how often do they settle, how do the awards turn out, how many hearings do they have, expert witnesses. Time doesn't permit me to go through all that now, but if you go to our webpage, it's all there. We released it very recently, and that information is there in a very transparent manner. So, item number one. Item number two. We have this pertains to reply to objections. Now, arbitrators know that occasionally, there are motions filed in arbitrations. And typically the way it works is a motion, the other side responds. And that's covered by the code. But what often happens then is there's a response to the motion, and we're trying to bring some order to that. So if we have that third element, again, motion, then a reply, if there's a response to the reply, starting in June, we set up by a notice to parties that moving parties have 5 days from receipt of a response to submit a reply to the reply. I know that's kind of circular, but again, for that third step, if you get a motion, response. If someone wants a reply to the response, it's 5 days because we have to basically have some order to the procedure and can't have this going on forever. Now on to legislative developments of interest. As I think you all know, the President signed into law the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. I think I'll call it Dodd-Frank to shorten things. That was signed in July, and it's a 2,000-plus page law that has many provisions involving the investing public securities markets. I will not go through them all now. However, part of it does potentially impact arbitration, specifically mandatory use of pre-dispute arbitration agreements. So what does the law do? Section 921 amends the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 to authorize the SEC to limit or prohibit use of pre-dispute arbitration agreements. How, you might ask? Well, one limitation is it allows the Commission to so limit use of pre-dispute arbitration agreements arising, and this is a quote, arising under the federal securities laws, the rules and regulations thereunder, or the rules of a self-regulatory organization. That's one limitation. And then it requires the Commission to find that such prohibition, and again I'm reading, such prohibition, imposition of conditions, or limitations are in the public interest and for the protection of investors. Now, we're not going to have a quiz to see how many of you out there have grasped that, so I'm going to circle back a little bit. Again, it authorizes the Commission to limit or prohibit the use of pre-dispute agreements, one, arising under the federal securities laws or the rules of the SROs. This raises a question, by the way, as to whether the Commission can regulate arbitration agreements involving state law claims. That's an open question, and if unresolved, my take is back to the days before Shearson versus McMahon back in 87, where you had issues about arbitration of intertwined federal and state claims. And the other major limitation, of course, is the Commission has to find that prohibiting or imposing conditions or limitations on pre-dispute arbitration agreements are in the public interest and for the protection of investors. One. Second, Section 964A4 calls for a recurring study by the U.S. Government Accountability Office of the SEC's oversight of National Securities Associations, that includes FINRA, by the way, and its dispute resolution program. So, a yearly study by the GAO of FINRA, including the arbitration program. Next, Section 922 amends the Commodity Exchange Act to prohibit use of pre-dispute arbitration agreements in whistleblower cases. That's a flat-out prohibition. And last, the law establishes a new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection and authorizes it to study pre-dispute arbitration agreements in consumer contracts, and similarly authorizes it to limit or ban the use of them. Now, it would appear that securities arbitration is carved out and left to the SEC. That's in Section 1028C. So the way the legislation seems to read is if something is carved out for the domain specifically of an entity, that entity has control. So it would appear that securities arbitration is left to the SEC. Now, FINRA's view on this, our chairman and CEO Rick Ketchum testified in October of 2009. There were hearings on the House Financial Services Committee, and his testimony was as follows, and I'm quoting, "FINRA has long maintained that a determination about whether mandatory arbitration agreements should be allowable is a decision best made by Congress and the SEC. Our view is that congressional or SEC action is necessary in light of Supreme Court precedent that upholds the ability of firms to contract in this way with customers." Well, now that Congress has spoken, FINRA stands ready and able to assist the Commission in any whatever way we can. A couple of points worth noting. We believe our arbitration program is fair by any reasonable measure and will defend the forum against attacks on fairness. Now, my colleagues are looking for my soapbox I usually get up on, and I think on these calls before I've gone through some of the many ways we feel our program is fair by any reasonable measure. I won't do that again. But suffice it to say, we think our arbitration program affords investors the opportunity to have their claims heard before highly trained and experienced arbitrators in a forum that's proven to resolve disputes in a fair, speedy, and economical manner. Second, it's important to worth noting that FINRA does not require firms to use pre-dispute arbitration agreements. There's sometimes a misperception. We do not require firms to use pre-dispute arbitration agreements. However, if firms choose to use arbitration agreements to ensure investor protection, we do regulate how firms use arbitration clauses. Take a look at Rule 3110F. It's a fairly explicit rule to protect investors that governs, among other things, the content and placement of arbitration clauses. Third, we believe it's essential for investor protection that FINRA Rule 12200, FINRA Code of Arbitration Procedure 12200, be maintained. This rule allows the customer to require the firm to arbitrate after a dispute arises, irrespective of whether there's an arbitration agreement or not. So where are we now? Current status, the SEC is accepting comments on pre-dispute arbitration, as it is among the, on the many, many other items in Dodd-Frank. I should note the Commission has several mandatory obligations, either rulemaking or studies under Dodd-Frank, that have to take place in the 6 to 12 months after the law was passed. That translates to starting this January. So several things that they need to do by way of rulemaking or studies fairly soon. And the statute does not require mandatory rulemaking or studies on arbitration. On a similar note, I'm delighted to inform our neutrals that President Obama has appointed FINRA Chairman and CEO Rick Ketchum to the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability. That group was established to promote and enhance financial literacy and capability among Americans, and we're proud that Rick is on that committee. On to other news for arbitrators. Expansion of the arbitrator pool. Due to increases in cases in certain hearing locations, we've had to create new pools of arbitrators to serve those cases where necessary. So, as a result, arbitrators will be less likely to serve on multiple cases involving that firm or product. Simply put, if we're in a hearing location with not that many arbitrators and we get lots of cases, very quickly we're exhausting the local pool of arbitrators, so we need to expand the pool. And the way we do that, as you know, is by contacting arbitrators in surrounding cities who are willing to travel at our expense to serve in that location. And we've done this before. It's very consistent with our existing practice of paying for arbitrators to travel from hearing locations with larger pools to smaller ones to help us supplement the local pool. And we thank all of the arbitrators on our roster who've agreed to do that. Now, we've had some recruitment initiatives as well. We can't rely on shipping arbitrators across the country to fill needs. So needless to say, we're working diligently to recruit additional arbitrators for the roster, including minority and female arbitrators. As an incentive to prospective arbitrators, as we've mentioned a couple of times, we're waiving the $125 fee for basic arbitrator training courses. Again, waiving that fee. And if we act now, at no extra charge, we're also waiving fees for arbitrators in our subject-specific online training modules. And normally, the tuition fee for those is $25 to $50, waiving that as well. We think that's a nice holiday inducement for arbitrators to complete their training where needed. And we encourage you to do so. Again, no cost. When you complete your training, let us know, because we do update each arbitrator's disclosure report to reflect that you've completed a FINRA training course. Now, there's some updated resources for parties and arbitrators worth noting. We've updated the hearing scripts and letters to encourage parties and counsel to voluntarily exchange in writing known information regarding potential conflicts between the arbitrators and any party, counsel, or witness. I mean, it seemed to go without saying, but we thought it was worth saying, so now we say it. To address concerns about information security and identity theft, we've also updated the hearing scripts to inform parties and their counsel of steps they can take to protect personal confidential information in documents they file with FINRA. For additional information, see our July 20th notice to parties on the website entitled Help FINRA Protect Your Personal Confidential Information. Next, last fall, and we've previously reported on this, dispute resolution in the St. John's Law School co-sponsored a securities dispute triathlon at the St. John's Manhattan campus. This was on October 2 and 3. I'm happy to report the triathlon was a huge success. And by the way, nobody was swimming in the Hudson River. This is a triathlon focused on skills. So for 2 days, law schools from around the country met to test their advocacy skills through three major areas: negotiation, mediation, and arbitration of securities disputes. Helping out were experienced neutrals from FINRA who served as mediators, arbitrators, and judges, helping the students by critiquing them, offering invaluable real-life experience. Everyone had a great time. It was a wonderful experience. The second year we've done this, and my hat's off to my colleague Ken Andrzejczyk for shepherding this important initiative through, and already we're preparing for next year's triathlon. There's some rules stuff that you might be interested in, and an approved rule change first. Every so often, a non-party witness will testify in a FINRA arbitration, and every so often, that person will show up with an attorney. Now, the rules already give the arbitrators the authority to exercise their judgment, and arbitrators do exercise sound judgment in those instances, but we felt it made sense to codify it a bit and just be really clear about what should happen in those instances. So on July 16, the commission approved a rule change that provides a non-party witness may be represented by an attorney at an arbitration hearing while the witness is testifying. Now, under the rule change, the panel determines the extent to which the attorney can participate at the hearing, as long as the attorney is in good standing and state law doesn't prohibit such representation. Also, unless the panel determines otherwise, the rule provides the attorney will be limited to asserting privileges such as the attorney-client or work product privileges or the privilege against self-incrimination. That rule change took effect October 14. Now, you've heard many times, and I'll just kind of update you, we have a proposed rule to revise the discovery guide. We've previously reported that the overall aim of that rule is to simplify the guide and reduce the burden of document production in cases involving customers. The key change is to reduce from 14 to 2 the number of lists of presumptively discoverable documents. Changes also address many of the comments submitted on the prior proposal that we withdrew a few years ago. Now, we filed the proposed change on July 12th. Probably not shocked to know that we've had many, many comments on this, and we're in the process of reviewing those now and intend to respond shortly. Finally, wrapping up case statistics, we had a huge increase, as you know, in cases last year. Things have tapered off a bit this year as compared to 2009. Parties filed through the end of November 5,241 cases. That's a 21% decrease in case filings compared to the same time in 2009. Still way above our low water mark in 2007, however. Many claims involve things that are not surprising: common stock, mutual funds. as well as fixed income products such as corporate bonds. Now, you may recall we forecasted in the past that processing times would probably start to go up as a result of the increased caseload. All of those cases that were filed in 2008, 2009 are bearing fruit now in the form of hearings, and things indeed have begun to slow down just a bit. I should note this is due primarily to party and attorney schedules, not the arbitrators. Looking at our statistics preliminarily through November, the time from the service of a claim through service of an award, which is what most people care about, is up by about 8% compared to 2009. Not surprising. We're hoping it doesn't increase much more than that. And again, full information on any of the statistics I covered or didn't can be found on our webpage. Wrapping up, what's new or what will be new next year? A few things worth noting. For many years, we've used the arbitrator's guide prepared by SICA, the Securities Industry Conference on Arbitration, which was prepared at a time when there were 10 SRO arbitration programs. There are now about five, but FINRA handles about 99% of all securities arbitration filings. So we've decided what makes sense, and SICA has agreed, to create a FINRA-centric arbitrator's manual. We're calling it the Arbitrator's Guide. That's about done. It will be web-based. I think you'll like it. It'll allow you to click on an area of interest and then drill down to get lots of detail. We hope to have that out after the first of the year. The Discovery Guide rule, if approved, of course, will yield changes to the Discovery Guide. And I'm sure Barbara Brady and her crew will develop training. Not sure if it's going to be free yet. We'll have to ask her about that. We'll also do new training, as mentioned before, on submitting expense forms. And, of course, if the customer choice rule is approved, that'll be big news, and there'll be plenty of advance notice and training on that as well. So, final note, and I speak on behalf of all of our colleagues here and in FINRA Dispute Resolution, I want to personally thank you, arbitrators and mediators, for your support, cooperation, and patience in 2010. FINRA Dispute Resolution strives to be the preeminent provider of securities-related dispute resolution services, and simply put, we can't do that without you. Now, we know beginning in November 2009 through most of 2010, we undertook a very labor and time-intensive project to verify the backgrounds of more than 4,500 arbitrators who joined the roster prior to 2003. The response from you all was overwhelming, more than 95%. I know it was difficult and it was somewhat intrusive, and I thank you, but it does an enormous amount to protect the integrity of the forum by us being able to say we have verified the backgrounds on every single arbitrator. Thank you very much. We also recognize that from time to time we ask you to complete surveys or take additional training, as the case may be. That puts demands on your time as well. And again, I assure you we do that only to increase the quality of the roster. Thank you for your time and effort there as well, and your patience and cooperation. Finally, on behalf of all of us here, we wish you and yours a happy and healthy holiday season and a terrific new year. Now I pass it back to Suzanne for a few final words.
Thank you, George. My thanks to you, George, Catherine, and Rick for being our featured speakers during this workshop. If you have any additional questions about this workshop, please send them to FINRA-DR Call-In Workshop. There's a link to this mailbox right below the link for the audio recording. Thank you for listening.